Now, we did have a merging of the papers in Decatur, in which we formed the, using one paper, and the headquarters would be down on North Main Street at North. And I'm not an expert on publication of a newspaper, but really much of the life of news in the community was involved around a newspaper. It was quite important for the editor to take part in the program of activities, events around the community. Also, the sports department was quite important to the community. But I'm not an expert on this particular field, but the transformation that has taken place from the days that I speak of, at the time when Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, to the present time, it's quite a revelation of difference of the employment, because back in, at Lindbergh's time, I was mentioning, that's when the newspaper was put together, the headlines and would be set by hand, but the reading material would be put on a linotype machine. And that is where hot molten lead would come down and cast a letter would be cast. So there was a lot of hand work in putting a paper together, and there was a lot of people involved, a number of people were involved in publishing a paper. It was a source of information for the community, because much of the outside information that came in on the wire services, such as the United Press and the Associated Press. So back prior to television and the early days of radio, for example, the wire service was the source of information. Now, particularly like in the baseball season, during the, say, the World Series, the Herald used to have a big board they would put outside the building on the street side. Possibly this board was at least 12 feet square, and it would be painted green, and there would be a a little baseball, like at home base. The news came out that there was a strike or a one base hit, the little ball would go up from home base up to first base. Now, the reason I speak of this, people would crowd around the front of the newspaper office, and they would stand there for hours watching this, the newscast that would come in on the wire service, and most of it would be written on these sheets of paper, like I mentioned before. If there's a home run or third out, what have you, it would be written, and people would stand in front of the newspaper office to get the very last minute news. Now, the same idea of having the last minute news is go to the front of the newspaper office and read these latest dispatches that would come in on the wire service. And particularly on election night, you see, now we sit at home, listen to the radio, and you get almost instantaneous results as it comes off of the computer. Back in those days, to get the latest news, you would have to go downtown to the newspaper office and wait outside till they post these bulletin boards written and pasted on the windows. And one of the novelty things that the Herald had was that they had a projector on the east side of the street, and they'd use slides. In other words, it'd be like a lantern. And they would, a slide projector, and they would throw this on a screen. So as the votes came in, people could see how the tally of the votes were concerned. Well, as I spoke, people would come from all over town to see this experience. Well, that meant that there would be hundreds of people, literally thousands of people, standing in the street. Well, now, if you happen to be a latecomer, there is, how would in the world would you get through this crowd? One little trick that worked beautifully. See, we had streetcars back in those days, and eventually a streetcar would have to come down the street. And so one of the secrets would be to wait till a streetcar came. And as the streetcar would ring its bell to get through the crowd, push the people aside, you would be at the back end of the streetcar that was walking. So as the streetcar made its way, you could follow and do very well. You could follow the streetcar, and when you got in front of the newspaper office, well, you could stop and you'd have a front row seat again. And a lot of people would do that. Well, you know, after so many hundreds of people pulled the same type of thing, the crowd would be so condensed down inside that they would have to move to the side. In other words, really what it meant was pushing somebody over. Well, that was one little aspect that was quite different. The period in the early 30s would also introduce something that was very much of a change in our whole life. Automobile was coming into its own. Matter of fact, it was quite the thing to see the new model of cars come out. But actually, because of the severe winters, no hard roads, a lot of cars would not be on the street. That is, very few cars would be driven the year round because it was almost impossible to start a car in cold weather, particularly like we had a few weeks back, sub-zero weather. So in the spring of the year was opening up a whole new life, people getting their cars out, getting them conditioned for summer driving. And it was wonderful to get out into the countryside in the spring of the year. But here we would be traveling on dirt roads. And dirt roads are very, very fine as long as they're somewhat moist and not too much dust. But it's hard to believe that our main highways would be a dirt road, and very special, some of them would be oiled. And if you'd ever tried to drive down a road with fresh oil, that was a very an experience you'll never forget, because the car would be covered. The old touring cars, which would be open sides, of course, and you'd even have oil over your clothes and possibly in your face. So this was a period when they were starting to talk about hard roads. And one of the first hard roads we had in this area would be the old Route 10 going east and west, and then the one going north and south up towards Bloomington, and then down south towards Pena. And to have a road that would be solid, so you could travel in the spring of the year when the thaw was coming out of the ground, was a revelation. At the same time, cars were not only, we had the touring cars, which you would put side curtains on during the winter time. And of course, thinking of winter time, there's very little heat in a car, so you'd wrap up in wool clothes, you'd have blankets, and you'd have a lap robe that you would always carry in the car. Because an open car or a car with side curtains on was very, very chilly, but even driving at 25 or 30 miles an hour. Well, eventually we had more hard roads built in this period of time, cars started to become much more sophisticated. We had the advent of the coming of the sedan, which is a closed car. We had the coupe, which is the one with the two doors. And also a heater was being improved a great deal, so driving in chilly weather and bad weather was much improved. So you didn't get quite as cold. But you see, the advent of the automobile was developing in every stages. For example, back in the late 20s and the 30s, if you had a set of tires on a car and you got 6,000 miles to a set of tires, you were doing something. That was really quite an experience. So the life of the tire was very short. Also, you had to learn to be a mechanic, because if you're driving down the road, it was quite common to pick up some nails in your tire and you'd have a puncture. So you'd learn to vulcanize the tire, change tires, and also you would also very likely learn how to adjust the carburetor and such, because they were in a lot of ways very simple in mechanism. They're not highly developed like they are today. But when you started out with a car, it was not a easy task, because you could get into a ditch very easily in mud. You'd have to go to a farmer with a team of horses and to pull you out. So early traveling was a thrill. One of my early remembrances of traveling in a car, it was a touring car, and we drove to Indianapolis on the old ocean-to-ocean highway that I mentioned earlier about the signs being painted on the telephone poles. We left after my father's business closed in the evening, which was about 10 o'clock at night, and we drove all night, and believe it or not, we arrived in Indianapolis the next morning in time for breakfast. Now, we had a lunch that was taken along, because say 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning you begin to get a little hungry. So we would have some little nibbles, and that was usually fried chicken and a banana and possibly some jelly sandwiches and such. Now, traveling in a car, like I mentioned, it was so dusty, it was quite the thing to have the ladies to wear dusters. And that was a very light fabric that would cover the entire body, and they had hoods, and you always had goggles, because to keep the dust out of your eyes. So when you prepared to make a trip, say to Springfield or to Bloomington or such, you would put on your dusters and your goggles in order to keep the dust. Or in the winter time, or the muddy time of the roads, why, that would be the same, for the same reason, to protect you. Now, one little experience I remembered that was quite interesting. When you bought a car, the dealer, in many cases, knew very little about the automobile. He gave you some basic information how to drive the car, but it was up to you to figure out how to drive it, more or less. And far as maintenance of a car, you knew you had to buy gas. It was necessary to keep oil in the car. But very little was ever said about a battery. And I can remember making a trip with my family one time, and we'd stop the car, and we couldn't get it started. And we would go from blacksmith shop, because that's where the mechanics a blacksmith would take on a new trade of being a mechanic. Very few repair shops, very few dealers had mechanic working for them. And so we get to, when the car would stop, we'd hung up a blacksmith or such, or find out if he could figure out why the car wouldn't start. And come to find out, the dealer forgot to tell my father that it was necessary to keep water in the battery. And the battery had gone, it was dry. And it was a very simple thing. And we still have problems with keeping water in batteries today, but at least it's one of the things we look for. And I spoke earlier about driving 6,000 miles on a set of tires. I can remember on one experience we had that the merchant that's selling tires talked my father into the idea of having the tires retreaded, giving a little more mileage to a set of tires. But on this particular trip, we had about 12 punctures in one day. We really didn't travel very far that day because of the time that was taken out to falconize the inner tubes and try to keep air in them. And by the way, talking about putting air in a tire, if you think that it isn't, it's an easy job today to go to a filling station and pull up and say, I need some air in the tire. And in those days, we had a hand pump, and it was necessary to pump the air into the tire, and it was a long, tedious job, and if it was a hot day, it was a sweaty job to get the air back into the tire. I spoke earlier about being with my father and the shoe business, which was operated on 148 East Main Street. And I spent many of my youthful days, particularly afternoons after school and on Saturdays in my father's store. And I like to reminisce just a little bit there. One of my first thoughts about the store was the old gas lights that they had inside the store. And gas lights were not the most convenient thing to have, and they were the hottest things. They would heat up a store. In the summertime, it was almost impossible to stay inside, so usually they'd only have just a few lights burning, primarily because of the heat. So the coming of the electricity as a popular means of lighting a building was quite an innovation. It was much cleaner, it was much cooler. Still, the old incandescent light was not as cool, of course, as the fluorescent lights that we have today. But it was such an improvement. Now, two or three things that would, you know, seem to stand out in my mind and remembrance of the old days. When I think I mentioned about wearing high top shoes, of course, the spring of the year, now here we are in February of 1984, we would be getting the merchandise in for spring and summer selling. And would be, ladies would put aside their high top shoes. Men would put away their high-top shoes and start thinking about wearing Oxfords. And that would be a change of a season, of course. And young people could hardly wait to get out in days like we are having experienced today with the temperature in the 20s or in the 40s and the 50s. Youngsters would like to get out of their boots, their high-top shoes, and put on their low shoes. And you would even find maybe a real brave boy or girl trying to go barefooted even a day like this, just to get out of their high-top shoes. Well, we're going from season to season, going into the spring, of course, going to low-top shoes and such. would be getting away from the mud and such, so the use of overshoes and boots and such would be not as important as in the fall of the year. Now, the approaching back in the possibly in the World War I period, in a shoe store, it was the center of activity because not too many families had too many pairs of shoes, and when they would come to town, they would usually fit the family up in shoes to last for at least 6 months. In the meantime, they would keep the shoes half soled, repaired, and I spent many of my early childhood days helping the repairmen, working in solving repairing of shoes, that is, taking heels off, helping him to sort out leathers, and particularly more or less of a cleanup job. And I learned a great deal of art of handling of tools, primarily from a very, very fine Swedish shoemaker. And he was actually a shoemaker because he would build shoes, make shoes from scratch for most of the work was done for invalids, where it was necessary to have one shoe made one way and the other shoe made another. And it was he was a beautiful craftsman. And I learned to use many of the tools from associating my days with Hugo Landin. I might mention that this Landin, Hugo Landin, had a brother, and the two of them left Decatur in the heyday of the theater period and went to California and made shoes for the theater trade, special shoes. And in other words, he followed his art and went out west to practice that in making beautiful shoes for the theater. Well, coming back to the shoe store in Decatur, I did spend many, many days there with my father and clear through high school and through college. And following when the Depression hit, I was completing my work at Milliken, and I still followed retail business and went to Chicago and worked for a chain organization by the name of Feltman and Kerm. And they were operating over 1,000 stores across the country, so they were just a large operation of disposing of shoes. But the reason I speak of that, I did go to Chicago and went to, I actually lived in Evanston, and commuted back and forth to Northwestern University to complete some credits that was necessary to get in order to get my degree from Milliken. And I speak of the Depression. I was very fortunate during that period of time of having a job. I even actually worked in a cafeteria in the morning for 2 hours in order for three meals a day. So I fared quite well. But the thing that it's hard to conceive now, that $15 a week was a big sum. And if a person had a job that even paid that much money, well, you would be more or less in a luxury stage. Automobiles, of course, were selling at a very low price. Rent was quite low. You could buy food for 35 cents for a complete dinner, 50 cents for a complete dinner. And there was actually at the during the Depression, when we had the World's Fair in Chicago, was one of the big changes in our whole life. Roosevelt was our president at that time, and he brought in the NRA, which did give us a basic wage scale, which was a big help to many, many people. One of the other things that took place was the introduction of the FHA, which is a federal home loan. Now, this applied not only to Chicago, St. Louis, Decatur, wherever you would go. Many families would work very, very hard to buy a home. And most of the mortgages would be on from a year-to-year basis. And during the Depression, when people would lose their jobs, had very little money, they would also lose their homes and possibly their entire life savings that they had put into this. So, coming back to Decatur now, I mentioned being in Chicago and the Evanston area, but coming back to Decatur, I think one of the great things that came out of the Depression was this federal home loan, because it gave working families an opportunity to own their homes without the fear of losing it. And some of our wealth that had been accumulated in Decatur through the years past would be from so-called loan sharks. And these people would just wait for someone to miss a payment on a property or the furniture, and then they would take it away from them and then resell the same object or piece of property. And it was very unfair, because many people sacrificed. And as I mentioned, wages were very low. And a person would get behind in their payments, they would be just almost destitute to lose their home, and which is a backbone of our whole society. So one of the great things that actually came out of the Depression was the fact that we did have a basic wage scale for people to more or less count on. They knew how much they were going to get. The other thing was their homes through the Federal Home Loan Act. Now, in the same period of time, I've mentioned about the automobile coming along. Radio was coming along in its great strides, making great progress. And then we had one of the things that I had mentioned, I think, earlier was concerning air conditioning. You know, this was a whole field that was developing, because refrigeration was making it possible for people to have a mechanical piece of equipment in their home to keep their food. And this is quite a step from the time when we had the ice wagon going up and down the street and counting on keeping your food by the means of ice. Here you had the new refrigerator that would keep a constant temperature day after day. So you could get, say, a quart of milk from the grocery store, and you could put it in the refrigerator, and you could keep it for 2 or 3 days. And speaking of milk, this was the period of time, another one of the innovations that came along was the pasteurization of milk. Now, prior to this, we had many types of diseases that would be picked up because of the milk had been contaminated somewhat. And the pasteurization of milk certainly was a tremendous step in for our whole mankind. Now, the other thing was, we speak of the refrigerator, one of the things we'd have when the milk we would purchase would be to remove the cream off of the top of the quart bottle, or a pint bottle, whatever it was, and the cream from that would be what you would use maybe in your coffee or your tea, or possibly on your cereal. But of course, of what was left was the more or less the skim part of the milk, which was not as rich. Now, we've learned in later years that we don't need quite as much of this richness like we thought of back in the 20s and the 30s. But also in the same period of time when we had the development of the refrigerator was the homogenization of milk. And that broke the particles up so the fat, a portion of the milk content, would be distributed evenly and would not settle to the top like I mentioned before. So there was another tremendous change that took place, not only in our refrigeration of foods. We started to have air conditioning in the houses. We started to have the keeping of food over a much longer period of time, because even back, I would say, even in the 30s, it was quite the thing to have a milk delivery every day. Then you went to two, maybe every other day. But the thought of keeping a quart of milk or a pint of milk or a gallon of milk would be almost impossible, because you couldn't keep milk over 2 or 3 days before it would sour on you. Now, with these radical changes coming along, the stores, of course, I speak of milk because primary to at that time, milk was dispensed in forms of bottles. We didn't even have paper containers. So now we do have the paper containers. We've been introduced to that. We've been introduced to the plastic containers, which is another innovation. And to think to go and buy a gallon of milk at a time and keeping your refrigerator for a period of days, it was quite a contrast from having to go to the grocery store or get a delivery at your home every day. And now, speaking of having milk delivered at your home every day, it was very important that you would go out and pick up your milk from the milk deliveryman very shortly after it was delivered, because if you happened to leave it out in the winter time, it would freeze and the milk would come out the top and push the cap off of the top of the bottle, and you would have a mess that way. Or if it was the summertime with the heat on it, if you didn't get your milk in before it got warm, you would have sour milk before you'd have a chance to use it. So there were quite a few changes in that respect. Now, speaking of retailing, after my experience of in Chicago, I did come back to Decatur, and I operated one of the Feltman & Kern stores, which was located on North Water Street in the 200 block. I was with Feltman & Kern for a number of years, and the later I spent a great deal of time with Lynn and Scruggs. Now, that was one of the stores that came to Decatur. Mr. Lynn and Mr. Scruggs, there was the Gushard store, and Mr. Gushard started a store. And most of them started with not thousands of dollars. They were limited as to how much they had, because in the early days, you didn't have fancy cash registers, not fancy fixtures in the store. They were very, very plain. But Lynn and Scruggs was one of the outstanding stores in the shopping area for many years. They had drapery materials, materials for making window shades of all sizes. They maintained a gentleman for that purpose. He had a very, very fine ladies' ready-to-wear sections. They had domestics, such as your sheets and pillowcases. They had housewares department, china. And in the earlier days, when in the building where the Millican Bank is located now, they even had a very, very fine tea room in the up on the second floor or third floor. The of course, Lynn's moved from that location over to North Water or North Main Street at Prairie and North Main, where Quicka Furniture Store is now located. But they still maintain a very fine store from the standpoint of quality merchandise. So anyone in the community that was interested in fine clothing, dresses, shirtings, linens for the bed and all, they'd always go to Linen Scruggs, or that would be one of the places they would shop. And in speaking of that, we had a number of very distinguished people, we might say, that the carriage trade. One of the last very, very wonderful women that traded with us was Mrs. Baldwin, Mrs. H.I. Baldwin, and she lived on West Main Street in the 400 block, and the house is still standing there, and it's the one that has a little iron fence around it. And Mrs. Baldwin always had her house painted in white. In the afternoons, as soon as the sun would start going down, her lights would go on. She had a number of candelabras around the house. And it was a little picture place or a show place. And they'd say that that house still has some timber in it that was cut by Abraham Lincoln. And it's supposed to be in that house, and it, of course, it's been covered many times by siding and what have you, but there is supposed to be some timber in there, that the house, the material that was cut by Abraham Lincoln. Now, I speak of Mrs. Baldwin because after the death of her husband, she wore white summer and winter. She was a lady of means, so she had a chauffeur that drove her in a black car, in a black Cadillac. And you'd always know when Mrs. Baldwin would be approaching, because you could see this car coming down the street with Mrs. Baldwin sitting in the back with her white clothes. Now, in relation to Lynn Scruggs, she would pull up to the side door, and Mrs. Baldwin would, the driver would get, the chauffeur would get out and let Mrs. Baldwin out of the car, escort her into the store. She would buy white kid gloves. Now, a lot of ladies don't know what white kid gloves are, but that was the thing of fashion in the years back. And many of them were gloves that you would wear up to the elbow. Beautiful French kid gloves. And we always tried to have on hand some white kid gloves for Mrs. Baldwin, because she was always in the market for buying another pair of white kid gloves. She also wore a powder that was pure white, no coloring, and we always managed to have some white powder for Mrs. Baldwin. There were other customers in the store that traded with us. We tried to be sure to have their needs, but I speak of Mrs. Baldwin because she was one of the outstanding and one of the gracious ladies that traded in the store. We would have families that would come to us that 20, 30 miles away, 40 miles away. They would come maybe once a year, and they would make the purchases of their sheets and their pillowcases and their blankets and material for making dresses and the pots and pans. And when they would leave to go home, it was, might say, just like a regular truckload of material, because they would gather these things for their coverage of their needs for a number of months. I, along with many other people, hated to see the old organization disappear, because it was a period of business life, community life, that is more or less history now. It's not just another chapter in the community, in a growing community. So the Linus Drugs is no more, and the years that I spent with them was very interesting, because I had many interesting associations with people such as Mrs. Baldwin. Another person that was quite interesting to work with was Mrs. Guy Scoville. Now, we associate the name of Scoville Park, the Scoville Golf Links, and Mr. Scoville was quite a successful businessman, and through the years he acquired a great deal of Oriental art, beautiful linens and such. And before Mrs. Scoville passed away, she was having the fun of the joy of giving many of these beautiful treasures away. And she would call me up on the phone and ask if I would get her a box to put some sheets in, or a pillowcase. Now, she would like to have nice white boxes, but she was having the fun of giving these beautiful treasures away that she possessed. And Mrs. Guy Scoville was another, was one of these interesting people that patronized Lynn and Scruggs. Lynn's did have a delivery service, and much of the business was taken or transpired over the telephone. People would call up for cosmetics, hosiery, and we would deliver them. And we even had some dear souls that would be handicapped, couldn't get out of the house, and they'd even call up, and we send out postage stamps. And we had a substation in the store, and they would charge this the postage stamps to this individual, and we'd send them out on delivery. And that was carrying the nth degree of service. But we did have that type of service to these people. Speaking of deliveries, I think one of the interesting things after World War II, and up to the particularly World War II, was the shortage of nylon and shirts and ready-made things. There was quite a shortage. And I can remember one lady calling up asking for some hose to be sent out. It was during this period when there was a shortage of goods. They were delivered, but the maid or the housekeeper received the package and put the package on the lady's shelf in their closet. A day or two later, the customer called and asked, wonder where the her hosiery might be, and said she had not received it. We had all records at the store that they had been delivered, and of course we had to take the lady's word for it that she did not get them after prolonged discussion. And about 6 months later, the dear soul called up and apologized profusely that she was very sorry that she found her stockings up on the shelf in their bedroom that the maid had put there and didn't tell her anything about it. So that was quite an experience. The one of the things, speaking of Lynn and Scruggs and the activities, they participated in a great deal in the Halloween parade and the Christmas celebration, and always in front of the store at Christmas time there would be a mural, a decoration on the front of the store. And some of the city stores yet, such as in Chicago and St. Louis, they still carry out that type of activity. So we missed that indicator by the store not participating in the display of Christmas decorations. I would like to say in closing that it is always interesting to see innovations, like I'm looking right now at an electric clock on the wall with the second hand moving around, which is very accurate. And I can remember as a child when we would hand wind a clock. Sometimes the clock would be fast, sometimes slow, and it was quite a help into our lives when we did get the new clocks. And I think the trade name, the thing that we thought of most, was the Telechron, which was a clock that gave us rather accurate timing. And of course, now we have the little clocks we wear on our wrists that are driven by battery source and are very accurate in timing. But looking back in the space of time of my 75 years of my life, the innovations and the things that have developed and have come about, there have been more things, as I've been told, in my lifetime than in thousands of years prior.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rogers. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Mr. Richard Rogers. This is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library.